Good morning. This is AM. I'm Tony Eastley. As Japan struggles to feed and shelter its homeless, aid the injured and recover its dead, there is fear, a fear that another disaster is in the making. One of the nation's nuclear power plants, Fukushima No. 1, is in serious trouble. Two of the reactors at that plant are reported to be in partial meltdown. As well, another plant, Fukushima No. 2, is in trouble, as are two other plants, Tokai, closer to Tokyo, and another one at Onagawa. The Japanese Prime Minister has said the nation has not faced a crisis of this magnitude since the end of World War II.
This earthquake and tsunami, and also the situation concerning the nuclear power stations, are perhaps the worst hardship that we've experienced after World War II. Whether we as Japanese people can overcome these hardships, that is dependent on each of us as Japanese citizens.
The death toll from the massive earthquake is hard to estimate. One town alone has 10,000 missing, feared dead. But as Japan tries to rescue, recover and mourn, it is faced with the spectre of nuclear radiation leaks. At the very least, the power station problems have left millions without heating and any way to cook food. Reporter Hayden Cooper is in Tokyo.
From the devastated northeast coast of Honshu, stories of survival are starting to emerge. These are tears of joy as one family is reunited for the first time since Friday. But there are many who are grieving. This woman lost her daughter in the tsunami. The wave struck suddenly, she says. I managed to grab something, but lost hold of my daughter's hand. I believe she's alive somewhere, but fear she may be found among the rubble. In Miyagi Prefecture alone, the police chief says 10,000 may have been killed. The nation's Prime Minister, Naoto Kan, says this is the greatest crisis Japan has faced since World War II. Today, his government is trying to prevent it getting any worse. At the Fukushima nuclear power plant, everyone is on high alert for a second explosion. That possibility remains, says the Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Edeno. But he adds the situation is improving since some pressure was released from Reactor 3. There are, however, mixed messages coming from the Japanese government. Despite yesterday's admission of a likely meltdown in both nuclear reactors, another spokesman, Noriyuki Shikata, says it hasn't happened.
No. That's not the case of a meltdown. And this is something we have been controlling, and the situation is under control.
And he won't even concede the reactors are damaged at all.
We have to, at the end of the day, confirm whether there is any damage to the reactor, but we have not found any indication of such significant damage in any way.
Government spokesman Noriyuki Shikata ending that report by Hayden Cooper. Former Japan correspondent Shane McLeod is in the Japanese city of Niigata. He's travelling on one of the few roads which are open into the tsunami-devastated region. Shane McLeod, what do we know about these plants?
Well, Tony, there are four of them that authorities here are concerned about. Of course, there's the two reactors at Fukushima, Fukushima number one and number two. There's also Onagawa, and there's also the Tokai plant.
And cited within one of these plants, one reactor is particularly in trouble.
Yes, so the main concern at the moment is about the Fukushima number one reactor, rather the Fukushima number one plant. And there are two reactors that are causing problems. There's the first one that people would have seen pictures of, the one that exploded on Saturday. Now, authorities have admitted now that there does appear there's been at least a partial meltdown of the reactor there. They're also very concerned about a second reactor there at Fukushima number one that seems to be heading the same way. And certainly I think that the government's expectation now is that they may suffer the same problem at that second reactor. So there's a 20-kilometre exclusion zone around Fukushima number one. There's also the Fukushima number two nuclear power plant where there are similar concerns. There's a 10-kilometre exclusion zone around that plant.
And adding to all of these problems, Shane, there is of course another site, an atomic site, even closer to Tokyo.
Yeah, there's the Tokai plant, which is probably about 120 120 kilometres or so on the north side of Tokyo. Now, they're having trouble with the cooling system at one of the reactors there, but they say they've got that under control. There's a backup cooling system that is working fine, and that's keeping the temperatures down at that reactor. Probably the one that's of more concern is a plant on the north side of the city of Sendai, which has obviously been very, very hard hit by the earthquake and the tsunami. At Onagawa, they're saying that there has been a release of radiation, but they still don't know exactly what that's come from, whether it was the venting of some high-pressure steam or if there's something more substantial happened. That's been declared as a low-level emergency, but obviously the information that's coming out of there at the moment is fairly scant.
Shane, in some or in all of these cases, have there been evacuations from around those plants? This nuclear emergency that is emerging, what impact is that having on the post-earthquake tsunami recovery?
Well, as you can imagine, it's just one further complication for rescue officials who, you know, would normally be just getting in there and trying to help people who've had damaged houses or who've suffered in the tsunami. Now they have to tread very carefully around these nuclear facilities. And this is a part of Japan where there are a large number of these nuclear facilities. It's not as dense. It seems that the area along the coast around Sendai has really copped the brunt of the tsunami that came after the earthquake, and that's really taken a devastating toll. So that's the Miyagi Prefecture. It seems to be particularly hard hit, and the authorities there are now talking about a death toll more than 10,000 people, and that may even be accounted for in, say, just one village that people might have heard about. Minami Sanriku is a town of about 17,000 people, and authorities can't account for more than half of the residents there. They're talking about perhaps 10,000 people in one town alone.
ABC correspondent Shane McLeod, who is in Niigata en route to the Miyagi Prefecture, which is the worst hit of the tsunami-affected region. Days after being hit by the earthquake and tsunami, Japan's flattened coastal communities are this morning without power, drinking water, and they're running very low on food. ABC correspondent Stephen McDonnell has reached one of the worst hit areas. He spent the night in Miyagi Prefecture and filed this report via satellite telephone.
Half an hour north of Soma City, we drove into Yamamoto Town. On the way in, we were greeted by rescue workers heading in the other direction. They urged us to turn around from this disaster-hit area, but were persuaded to let us through when they found out we were journalists from the ABC. The fields either side of the road are still littered with the cars that had been picked up by the tsunami and washed inland. Not a single house in this town has been left alone. Those structures that are left standing have been invaded by the rocks, mud, dirt and trees that were carried along by the powerful tsunami that was triggered by Japan's worst earthquake in recorded history. One lounge room I saw appeared as if somebody had decided to build a twisted, ugly forest right in the middle of it. But many buildings have not been left standing. Some have been bent on their sides like a child's plaything. Others have had their walls and roofs smashed in. Some have been ripped from their foundations by the fast-moving water and deposited elsewhere. The worst, of course, have been completely smashed to pieces. Soldiers from Japan's self-defense force drive around wearing face masks. Some are in white suits, spraying the area with a type of disinfectant. Military helicopters fly overhead, and a good many sirens can be heard off in the distance in all directions. The fire brigade drives around, issuing warnings of more potential tsunamis on their loudspeakers. But they're not talking to many people, because Yamamoto Town is virtually deserted. Apart from the destruction to people's homes and most structures, there's no power, no drinking water, and nothing much to eat. The few people who are hanging around have missing friends and loved ones. We met one man who'd escaped the tsunami by climbing a tree, though what's left of his house now has a truck inserted in the side of it. He managed a laugh. He's glad to be alive. An unknown number of his neighbours are not as fortunate. This is Stephen McDonnell in Yamamoto Town for AM.
The escalating nuclear crisis in Japan has experts in the US divided over the scale of the threat. Some say even if the situation doesn't get any worse, it's already one of the biggest nuclear disasters the world has seen. Others believe even with a partial meltdown, the crisis can be contained without significant radiation danger. North America correspondent Lisa Miller reports.
It's now 30 years since the US faced its biggest nuclear disaster in Pennsylvania with the partial meltdown at Three Mile Island. There were conflicting statements about the extent of the damage and the danger over the first few days. International experts are still attempting to understand the enormity of the problem now facing Japan. Joe Ciricioni is the president of the Plowshares Fund.
This is already one of the worst nuclear accidents in history if it stops right now. And we're dealing with multiple meltdown possibilities.
Marvin Fertel from the pro-industry group, the Nuclear Energy Institute, doesn't believe there's yet reason to panic.
At Three Mile Island, which was the worst accident we ever had, about half of the core melted, so about 50%. It resulted in the machine never operating again. It resulted in no releases off-site that threatened anybody. So you can have fuel melt, and if the rest of your safety systems, your containment works and your primary system works, and you manage to keep the reactor under control, the dangers for public health and safety are really minimal. And that's the thing the Japanese are trying to do right now.
Japan's ambassador to the US, Ichiro Fukisaki, appeared on morning talk shows and was asked if pumping seawater into the facility was a sign the situation was dire.
If there's clear water, it would be better for reactor itself, but in order to cool down, seawater would have the same effect as clear water.
What is
the effect we are trying to get is trying to get the reactor to cool down.
And he stressed that the explosion seen at the Fukushima facility was not dire.
There was an explosion and in the first reactor regarding, but it was not a reactor nor container. It was an outer building. It didn't have any radiographic material getting out of the container or reactor. So I have to emphasize that part.
Two US nuclear experts have already flown to Japan and others may follow to assist that country grapple with this crisis. This is Lisa Miller in Washington for AM.
You're listening to AM on ABC Radio National, where it's approaching 23 minutes past 7. The noose is tightening around rebel forces in Libya. Rebels opposed to Muammar Gaddafi's regime have been forced to withdraw from the town of Brega in the east of the country after coming under heavy attack from government troops. Brega is the second rebel-held town to fall after the key oil port of Ras Lanuf. For more, I'm joined by the ABC's correspondent, Tim Palmer, who's in Benghazi. Tim, good morning. Are we seeing the end of the people's revolution against Colonel Gaddafi?
It's certainly a popular uprising that turned into a civil war that's starting to look a bit like a rout at the moment. There are four main things that have suddenly turned this completely in Colonel Gaddafi's favour. One is the military superiority, his regular forces out here in East Libya, where they've run through Ras Lanuf and now Brega and now pressing towards a town of 200,000 people at Asabia. The second is the strict loyalty of his son's crack battalions who've moved into towns like Zawiya and now look like crushing Misrata the same way. On top of that, there's the delay in any international intervention in a no-fly zone, and he is certainly outpacing those diplomatic moves in the speed that they're eating up the rebel territory. And finally, you'd have to say the Japan earthquake's in his favour, because I think they're keenly aware that the media attention of the world has turned away for a moment.
Tim, what areas are still held by rebel forces?
It's a shrinking area. They are still holding Misrata, but it is encircled, and the suggestion is that those special battalions attached to Gaddafi's sons are on their way to push in there and smash it the same way it smashed the uprising in Zawiya. Now, if that happens, it will simply be the one unified patch of territory spreading out from Benghazi, nearly a couple of hundred kilometres down towards Asabia, where the Libyan army troops are now on the outskirts and just about within missile and artillery range, and then out towards Tobruk and the border areas. They have that contiguously. The problem is if Asabia falls, or even if the army can encircle it, they'll then have access to the desert road that cuts straight across to Tobruk or to a point way between Tobruk and Benghazi. They'll be further able to isolate and possibly then move to take off Tobruk and access to the border, and it will be Benghazi and Ajdabiya, but pretty much the sole territory, a radius of only a few hundred kilometres that the rebels hold.
I mentioned, Tim Palmer, that you're in Benghazi. Do you get the feeling there that it could be just a matter of days or perhaps a week or so before Gaddafi might be able to be in the position to lay siege to that town that you're in?
Well, I think siege from a distance could happen certainly in the coming days or week. That is, if they don't try and press here. The way they've been going, Misrata has been under siege now for some significant time while they've dealt with Zawiya, and it looks really as if they're going to deplete the forces, lay siege to the place, make it difficult to get supplies in, and then start tightening the noose, as you say, bit by bit. This is a major population centre, and even Ajdabiya with 200,000, it's going to take them a while to work through there. By the time they get to Benghazi, it's going to be a significantly different type of urban battlefront for them to deal with. The one hopeful sign from the rebels is that their commander was saying today, OK, they've lost these small, albeit strategic, oil towns further off to the west of here, that he wasn't sounding too worried because he suggested it was mainly very enthusiastic, underarmed volunteers that had rushed off there, that they have held back and tried to organise some army forces to organise a proper strategic defence of these major centres around Benghazi, and they have held their more regular troops back waiting for Gaddafi.
ABC correspondent Tim Palmer, who's in the rebel-held town of Benghazi. The Prime Minister has returned home to another bad poll. Today's Sydney Morning Herald Age AC Nielsen poll has the Coalition retaining its record lead over the Gillard government. In another blow, her personal approval rating has taken a nosedive, with more voters saying they'd prefer Kevin Rudd as Labor leader. Tony Abbott is in the same predicament, though. The polls have him trailing the man he deposed, Malcolm Turnbull, as preferred Liberal leader. And the government faces more questions over its ditched emissions trading scheme. From Canberra, Alexandra Kirk reports.
Tossing a football around the Oval Office with the President of the United States and addressing Congress hasn't boosted the Prime Minister's stocks or those of her government. In today's AC Nielsen poll, the Coalition retains a decisive 8-point lead after preferences, echoing last week's news poll. John Sturton says the biggest thing that's happened in his Nielsen poll is that Julia Gillard's approval rating dropped 5 points to 47%, her lowest since taking the leadership. 47% disapprove, meaning a net approval rating of zero.
What that tells us is she's taking a hit probably over the carbon tax and the broken promise, or the perceived broken promise.
Tony Abbott's taken a smaller hit, but his disapproval rating is the highest since becoming leader. Voters are nostalgic, preferring Kevin Rudd to lead Labor. He's 5 points ahead of Julia Gillard, though among Labor voters, she's the most popular. Bill Shorten and Greg Combey are a long way back, both on 9%. Similarly, Malcolm Turnbull trumps Tony Abbott by 6 points as preferred Liberal leader, but Mr Abbott's the winner with Coalition voters. Nielsen's John Sturton says both leaders are struggling.
Federal politics has always been tough, but I think over the last year or so it's been much more combative than usual. And voters generally don't warm to that sort of approach, and it tends to drag both leaders down, and that's really what we're seeing now.
As Tony Abbott takes his anti-carbon tax crusade to Western Australia for the next couple of days, the opposition's got hold of Labor's draft plans for a $30 million taxpayer-funded advertising blitz slated for January last year. It centred on Kevin Rudd's emissions trading scheme, but was dumped, as was his CPRS. Liberal Senator Simon Birmingham, who obtained the documents under Freedom of Information, has challenged the Prime Minister to rule out dusting off this campaign or using the unspent money on a new one.
We've seen before now that government advertising campaigns are often viewed with cynicism by the public. They often see through them. They saw through them with the mining tax. They probably saw through it under the former coalition government with work choices. I think if this government is silly enough to spend tens of millions of taxpayer dollars trying to convince people about a tax that will dip further into their pockets, they will find that it probably backfires and costs them more than it does benefit them.
Liberal Senator Simon Birmingham ending that report from Alexandra Kirk. To the financial markets, and they're increasingly nervous with the quake adding to the unrest in the Middle East and the re-emergence of sovereign debt concerns in Europe. Not surprisingly, insurance companies will be under pressure. The dollar is up, buying 101.5 US cents. I'm Tony Eastley. That's AM for today. And it's 7:30. Very good morning to Fran Kelly.
Good morning, Tony.
Fran, I was just so distracted all weekend about the events in Japan, and now I find that, you know, when you're talking about other subjects, other than the earthquake and the devastation there, they just seem so inconsequential.
It's incredible how everything gets put back in perspective suddenly, isn't it? I know.
Yes, tit-for-tat politics just doesn't rate when you've got post-apocalyptic scenes coming out of Japan.
And that's exactly right.
Some of those areas, I don't know whether you've been there, but I've travelled in Tokyo and around that area a little bit, and it's just so awful to see what's happened to those communities.
Yeah, it's shocking. We're going to cross to Sendai, which is one of the towns right smack in the middle of that front line of the tsunami in
Good
a moment,
you.
So we'll get the latest from there. Thanks very much, Tony.